nous allons nous y mettre. Donc, cet après-midi, nous avons deux exposés qui vont faire intervenir pour la première fois, depuis le début de ce séminaire, des personnages importants, pittoresques et problématiques, qui sont ces gens qu'on appelle les songsheux, c'est-à-dire les litigation masters, alors en français, j'avais trouvé quelque part avocatier, qui est joli, mais peut-être pas très français. Disons, ce sont ces personnages qui proposaient aux gens qui allaient en cours. Merci. Ah voilà, merci beaucoup. De les aider, de les conseiller, qui n'étaient pas des avocats au sens où ils n'avaient pas le droit d'aller eux-mêmes traiter avec la cour, et qui étaient accusés par les fonctionnaires et par le pouvoir d'encourager les gens à faire des procès. Donc il y avait une mauvaise presse. Donc c'est songeux. Aussi bien l'exposé que va nous donner tout de suite Monsieur Chen Li, que l'exposé suivant de Qiu Pengsheng tourner autour de cette proximité entre ces songeux qui sont ni des fonctionnaires ni des, enfin qui n'appartiennent pas à l'appareil gouvernemental, et les fonctionnaires et encore plus les conseillers techniques, les mouillots. Là on a un milieu de juristes dont il va être question donc dans ces deux exposés. Et avec le troisième exposé de Jérôme Bourgon, nous élèverons vers des cimes quasiment philosophiques, puisqu'il va nous parler du I Ching. Tout se termine toujours par le I Ching en Chine, ou commence par, et ce sera, je pense, une digne conclusion de ces sessions. So, Professor Chen, it's your turn.
Okay. Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank Professor Will for inviting me to be here. And can I have light?
Light?
Yeah, I need to look. So you cannot turn off the rest of it, or?
You mean I have light just for you?
Yeah, I don't know whether they wanted the lights or not. So actually, okay, it's okay. Okay, sorry.
Sorry. Vous voyez bien là? Oui, donc l'écran est un peu dans le... Oui, ça va.
So you can see, okay. Again, I want to thank Professor Well for inviting me to be here and to share some of my preliminary findings with you. And I have been working on this topic for, so far, I think 7 or 8 years. So it's great for me to at least to present something at a very preliminary stage. As you can see, the title was intended to be provocative by invoking the argument made by one of the most famous scholars of Chinese law and society, Qu Tongzhu. He once argued there was a process of Confucianization of the law since the Han Dynasty on. So this paper is partly intended to explore whether there is also a possible process of he was arguing the Confucianization of the law from the Han Dynasty on. I'm trying to see whether there is also a parallel process of legalization of Confucian scholars in at least the late Imperial China, or especially in the Qin period. My talk will also try to highlight the efforts made by Qin legal specialists. By that I mean legal advisors, or Xinminbuyu, or Xinmu. I know most scholars so far have used the term private secretaries or private legal secretaries to refer to them. But I think there is a significant difference between what they did as legal specialists and what other secretaries or clerks did in local government. So I want to use legal advisors or legal specialists to refer to them. I also want to highlight how these Qin legal specialists tried to capitalize or to enhance their cultural capital and to increase their social space in face of especially increasing restrictions imposed by the Imperial Qin court upon these legal specialists out of concern of their monopoly on legal knowledge to their selfish interest. And this is a very brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. And I think one of the most enduring puzzles for modern students of Chinese history concerns the role of law in ordering late imperial Chinese society, which was presumably founded upon and largely governed by Confucian philosophy, morality, and rituals. So we all know the Max Weber's argument or his characterization of imperial Chinese law as irrational cadre justice, which was administered by Confucian literati. Oh, sorry, there was some typo there. Literati according to Confucian morality and arbitrary sentiments, not by legal specialists and not based on established or external laws and established procedures. So that's one of the very controversial and still, I think, influential paradigms a lot of especially Western scholars since the late 19th century often invoked to characterize the late imperial, especially imperial Chinese law. And again, I mentioned Qu Tongzhu's famous argument about the Confucianization of Chinese law from the Han Dynasty on. So those are some of the backgrounds against which I want to explore a possible process of legalization of Confucian literati in the Qin period. In the talk, I will first sketch out the background and the historical emergence of these legal specialists. Again, literally the term muyo can be translated into friends in the tent. Ximi muyo or ximu were a more specific subcategory of this term, and they refer to the muyo who were specializing in law and sometimes also did work in fiscal matters. But I will focus on these ximi muyo, and I will use private legal advisors or legal advisors to refer to them. I was working on the slides last night. That's why you see some typos about the numbering. The third part will be about the legal training of Qin legal advisors, and that will be very brief as well because there's a lot I want to cover, so I have to be very selective. Then after that, I will discuss how their legal training and also their legal profession helped build up or shape their juridical philosophy and also their professional identities and ethics. Then after that, I will use some case studies to illustrate the role of Qin legal advisors in shaping Qin law and Qin legal culture as well as Qin jurisprudence. In terms of the implications of this kind of study for the study of late imperial Chinese law and society, preliminarily I argue that by closely studying and re-examining the role of Qin legal specialists and also their publications, we can get a much better understanding of the process and the impact of the specialization or arguably even professionalization of Qin legal specialists. And also, I want to highlight their historical contribution to the formation and development of Qin jurisprudence, especially forensic jurisprudence, which was discussed by Professor Well in one of the book chapters he recently published. And also, the third part of the implications, I think, is concerning the influence of Qin legal advisors on local officials and also local governance. To what extent these legal specialists who were, in theory, outside of the traditional officialdom, actually exerted a considerable influence on the ways local Qin, especially Qin local governments, were operated. So those are the few themes I want to cover very briefly in this talk. First of all, I want to focus on the historical emergence of Qin legal advisors. With a few exceptions, modern scholars on China have thus far paid relatively little attention to the historical significance of Qin legal advisors, even if a lot of them have mentioned this group of specialists in passing in their works. I think a very typical example is the works published in English by especially US scholars over the last two decades or so on Chinese law and society. most of them only mention the Qin legal advisors very briefly, including Philip Huang and so on. So I think to better appreciate Chinese legal tradition, it is imperative for us to re-examine the story of Qin legal advisors, especially in relation to the contention that imperial Chinese law was subordinated, crippled, or even replaced by Confucian morality and sentiments. And scholars on this topic have generally agreed that this Xin Min Bu You first emerged as a widespread phenomenon in the late Ming and early Qin. One possible explanation was that seriously understaffed officials during the late Ming gradually spread and normalized the practice of hiring private individuals or private advisors to assist them in local governance. And this practice continued into the Qin and became a nationwide phenomenon for the next 2.5 centuries. In 1651, the term Muyo was already used by Emperor Sun Zhi in his in one of his imperial edicts. So that's one of the official kind of appearance of this term into the Qin political realm. And it was not long before it became evident that most, if not all, local officials, including or ranging from county magistrates up to provincial governor generals, tried to rely upon the experience and expertise of private advisors in carrying out their daily the duties as a local administrators. And we can get some hint about this development from a place most famous for producing private advisors during this period. In the gazetteers of the Shaoxing County of Zhejiang Province, I searched the whole gazetteers, and in the late Ming, we can only identify 4 muyou from this place. But in the Qin period, I identified at least 150 muyou from this county alone in the throughout the Qin period. So you can see the kind of almost voluminous increase in the number of muyou produced by this locale. As I mentioned, a host of factors contributed to or even worsened the situation during the Qin period that necessitated the heavy reliance upon these private advisors. I mentioned a couple of factors here. For example, the lack of emphasis on legal study in the process of selecting official candidates has been often cited as one of the major factors. And also the increase in the complexity and volume of laws, especially in the Qin period. And many scholars of Chinese law know the increase in the number of sub-statutes, especially in the 18th and early 19th centuries. And also due to the increase in the population across the empire, and also the kind of social stratification and increase in conflicts, that resulted in the increase in the number of crimes and litigation as well. And as I also mentioned, local officials, certainly not just starting from the Qin, even in the Ming, it was already very obvious that a lot of local officials were seriously understaffed and restricted by, in terms of their financial resources, to hire personnel or to get outside help in assisting their local governance. And so those are the kind of the factors that lay out the historical background or backdrop against which private legal advisors emerged as a very prominent group of assistants in local governance. Now I want to move on very quickly to the training process of Qin legal advisors. For me, it's very interesting to see how these otherwise Confucian literati acquired the kind of special legal knowledge that made them indispensable to Qin local governance and judicial administration. So I wanted to see to what extent the legal training, the process of the training itself, helped to shape their identity and also their perception and attitude toward judicial administration and even law and justice in general. In the Qin period, as far as I can tell from the various judicial handbooks and all the sources about Qin legal advisors, Qin legal advisors got their legal knowledge or expertise through a combination of book learning and apprenticeship, or what we would call probably internship nowadays. And it's very much like what their professional counterparts in Euro-American, contemporary Euro-American, or nowadays modern societies did. It would be much easier for those who have relatives as legal advisors to get this kind of internship or apprenticeship opportunity. For that reason, the kind of the advantage of access explains why a number of Qin legal advisors came from families which produced a relatively significant number of legal advisors. For example, a Tao family in Shaoxing County in Zhejiang, again, Zhejiang, Shaoxing, Zhejiang, boasted as many as 39 private advisors. And I will give you a very an example about a very famous political figure in the late Qin, early Republican, Wang Jingwei. I think all of the scholars of China know this person. And he's from a family of Muyou. And but for the collapse of the Qin, actually, Wang Jingwei would be placed on that path as well. He would become a Muyou if he did not join the revolutionary cause, became one of the most famous political figures in the early Republican period. And his, I think, a great-grandfather, Wang Jie, was the kind of the founding figure in this family. He was the first Muyou for the, and his son, Wang Din, was another legal advisor, private legal advisor, very active in Guangdong and Guangxi, very famous. And Wang Jie's grandson, Wang Quan, also was a legal advisor. And Wang Quan's cousin, Wang Qiao, was another legal advisor. And Wang Qiao was the father of Wang Jingwei. So you got a sense. And also, Wang Jingwei's cousin, Wang Zaoyong, was another legal advisor. He was the last legal advisor of this family. And Wang Zaoyong died in 1939. So with a span of about 180 years, we got 11 mostly legal advisors from this single family in Shaoxing, Zhejiang province. And in their process of apprenticeship, the legal advisors, or the kind of candidates of legal advisors, were supposed to immerse themselves in a wide range of law books, including statute books or books of substatutes, regulations, and also collections of legal cases. And they were expected to equip themselves with the legal jargon. Then they should know the nuances between different legal provisions, and they should know how to interpret a particular provision. And so the next step, after they have got the basic knowledge of the law and cases, they were they would be asked to learn how to apply a law to a particular case based on some of the old cases handled by their masters or by others. And then the third step, I mean, this is certainly not uniform. It's just some of the kind of steps recommended by the most prominent legal advisors. Certainly did not apply to all the apprentices. Third step was to draft documents, official correspondence, and then propose judgments on a particular case. And all of this work would be supervised by his master in the local yamen, who was a practicing legal advisor, and the master would often offer comments on how the apprentice did his work. And after about 1.5 years, the apprentice would move on to a higher yamen or higher local official's office, like in the prefect's office or the provincial judge's office, to learn how to handle bigger responsibilities. So they started with the county magistrate's yamen and then move on to higher level of the judicial hierarchy. In addition to the law books, they were also supposed to read a lot of books, general books on history, literature, Confucian classics, in order to develop a humanistic or even holistic view of justice and law, so they will not become just petty technicians or only specialists in law who knew nothing about literature and history or local sentiments. So it was supposed to be expertise grounded in more general education and humanistic understanding of the way justice operated. And with this kind of legal training, then an apprentice, often with the help of his master or his own family networks, would seek replacement, a job placement after about 3 years. So on the average, they needed to spend 3 years on the apprenticeship process. After 3 years, they would start to work for a local official, mostly for a county magistrate first, and then if they did a good job, they can move on to higher official's office. But this process of training was very rigorous, according to some of the famous chief legal advisors. And it was even said by one legal advisor that only one out of 10 apprentices could survive the process. So the kind of attrition, what's it called, attribute, the process essentially filtered out a lot of candidates for legal advisors. Well, it's just a representation, so whether that really represents or says something about the quality of the legal advisors or not, that's still that is open to further research. Now I want to, I forgot when I started, so I don't want to keep you too long. Shall I assume?
No, that's okay, you
have 15
more minutes.
Oh, 50, okay, so, okay. 15?
Oh,
okay.
Or a little more if you want.
No, you mean 15 minutes?
15.
Of quarter
of an hour. Oh, okay.
No, we started about 2:40. So, no, you have
20
minutes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Oh, you don't have to, but.
Okay, actually, I might need more. But, in any event, when Qin legal advisors became very essential to local governance, there was also a tendency to paint them in a negative light, especially in the near the end of the 19th century. So we saw a lot of the typical negative or typical critical comments on legal advisors, just as clerks, yamen runners, and so on, in the late 19th, early, especially in the late 19th century. But I want to argue in my own paper, I want to approach this issue from a different angle. I want to see to what extent that is just a representation or even an approach adopted by the Qin Imperial Court in order to put some pressure upon the conduct and also the influence of Qin legal advisors. So here I will discuss instead how the Qin legal advisors represented themselves as people who upheld justice, who served justice, and who protected public interests. So it was a kind of competing discourse about themselves, competing with the Qin Imperial Court or some officials who tended to portray them in a negative light. The first aspect of this, of the efforts of legal advisors to represent themselves as virtuous or upright legal specialists who helped promote justice was concerning the kind of the, I would call the empowerment of legal expertise and a professional autonomy and identity that started to take shape, at least by the early 19th century. Even though it was probably true that most people still preferred to become an official rather than a private legal advisor in the Qin period, but Qin legal advisors challenged the view that their specialized knowledge reduced themselves to petty technicians or debased instruments of local administration. For them, they took it very seriously, and often more seriously than their hosting officials, to uphold moral principles and to do justice. They might be paid by the hosting officials, but legal advisors argue that they were highly conscientious of their duty to the public and to justice, and they should properly enforce the law and serve the people. In order to do so, they had to maintain their personal integrity and their professional autonomy from the hosts when they were handling legal matters. By the same token, a legal advisor must be careful about the personal character and reputation of the officials they worked for. So he should be, for example, one legal advisor should be scrupulous in selecting what kind of official he wanted to work for. And according to Wang Huizhu, probably many of you know, one of the most famous legal advisors in the Qin, whether an official had virtue and integrity often determined whether a legal advisor could properly carry out their duty, his duty. And Wang boasted that all the 14 magistrates he worked for were upright and virtuous officials. And to the modern mind, a legal advisor might appear not very different from a subordinate clerical staff or secretary of the hiring official. But actually, in the Qin period, the relationship was very different. An official invited and treated a legal advisor not as his subordinate, Liao or Su, but as his guest, Bin, or friend, You, or even tutor, Shi. So their relationship was more akin or very much like that between friends and peers, instead of between an employer or superior versus an employee or inferior. When such a relationship was translated into the daily operation of local governments, a responsible legal advisor could choose to stick to his own opinion or principle without subjecting himself to the official's pressure when applying the law. Ideally, he should not himself be swayed in any way by self-interested concerns or by the desire to keep his job at the office. So if, one way to put it, if a legal advisor felt his advice was not honored or respected by the official, he ought to just pack and leave. So that is one of the kind of approaches adopted by legal advisors to represent themselves as virtuous and upright. And another competing claim made by a legal advisor was the different representation of justice or ideal justice they claimed to serve. The relative autonomy I just mentioned was only possible because of the educational credentials and also the expertise legal advisors had. High-sounding Qin officials like Governor General Tian Wenjin of the Yongzheng period would urge local officials not to rely too much upon legal advisors, but that was often the kind of ideal instead of reality. And it is true that some Qin local officials had significant administrative experience before their appointment, like Wang Huizhu, Liu Heng, and so on. They were legal advisors before they became officials. And those officials had the expertise probably more than most other officials. And some officials also set up a Keliguan, a kind of academy or institutions near their offices to train official candidates. For example, Gang Yi did that in Shanxi. So he said he collected a lot of legal treaties to put them into the Keliguan to train future officials. But still, most of the local officials, even if they had enough expertise to handle legal matters, they had to rely upon a legal advisor to assist them in the administration because of the workload was too much for them to handle alone. When legal advisors realized their value or their indispensable status in the local yamen or office, they also started to claim a different kind of justice. One of the educational officials in the late Qianlong era, Xie Jinwan, once claimed there were two kinds of justice. One is Gong Shi Zi Xing Ming here. The other type is Ru Zi Zi Xing Ming. So according to him, the first one is a kind of mechanical formulaic application of the law based on the letter of the law instead of the spirit of the law. And then there's Confucian application of the law, the rules of the Ximing. So the well-educated Confucian literati scholars can apply the law differently from the specialists whom he referred to the Qin legal advisors. According to Xie Jinwan, the legal advisors can only accomplish the first type, the mechanical application of law. They could not accomplish the second type of justice. That was the kind of the argument made by a lot of Qin local officials in order to distance themselves or distinguish themselves from their assistants or legal advisors. But actually, for some prominent legal advisors, they could do exactly the same, the kind of the more well-rounded or better informed application of the law, which was not just based on a mechanical reading of the statute, the text of statute, but rather they had to take into consideration all the relevant factors in a particular case in order to make sure that the law was applied to that case justly. And in response to the rather dismissive attitude demonstrated by Xie Jinwan and some of his colleagues, Qin legal advisors and their sympathizers often claimed that officials actually in general were concerned so much about their job security or promotion that they could hardly have the time to study the law carefully and understand the statutes or sub-statutes carefully or thoroughly. As a result, even some of the officials had the expertise that still had to rely upon their advisors. In contrast, legal advisors had the expertise and undivided devotion to legal matters to ensure justice and equity in judicial administration. So a number of leading legal advisors were lauded or eulogized for administering criminal justice or justice in general equitably and with extreme care according to the law, balanced with the principle of mercy, and only those leading advisors were able to achieve the kind of ideal justice they advocated. Importantly, by such means, although legal advisors were not the nominal judicial authorities, they were to punish the offenders and maintain social norms and legal order. One of the third kind of major themes leading legal advisors promoted was concerning the judicial philosophy, especially what kind of justice or humanity they wanted to achieve. More specifically, leading legal advisors explicated how their ideal justice could be achieved in judicial practice. For example, they demonstrated a very strong sense of appreciation of the importance of their work or their legal profession. They repeatedly stressed that their proper interpretation and application of law could be a matter of life and death to those involved. So they had to be careful about how the law was applied. Another popular theme in legal advisor judicial writings was their emphasis on the reliability of or on the effort to ensure the authenticity and accuracy of evidence when deciding a case. For such purposes, they suggested that various measures should be used or adopted to ensure evidentiary accuracy and to avoid wrongful judgments and punishments. So most of them argued against any use of judicial torture, especially they condemned the use of illegal judicial torture. I mean, I don't have time for the details about the differences, but in the Q&A, I would be glad to answer any question about this. They also argued against administration or imposition of severe punishments, especially unnecessary severe punishments. Here I put some quotes here. I argue actually that Qin legal advisors claimed that they should, one of the age-old Chinese juridical principle they should honor was that the accused person should be given the benefit of doubt, especially in capital cases. I put a Chinese quotation here. It's in the second, actually under item three. Wang Weihai mentioned, probably if you know Chinese, it would be much easier. Basically, 法律要宽一分所谓与其杀无辜临时不禁然非重之谓也情真罪当自当自知重点处事贵德中 不是调及乎宽严之间而执其中亦宽一言赏之而非施杀之而不愿便是德中. The English translation roughly is the law ought to be a bit more lenient in enforcement. It is better to err on the side of leniency than to wrongfully kill the innocent. However, it is not to call for connivance at crimes. If the crime is proven and the penalty is proportional, the defendant ought to be punished strictly. In practice, it is essential to strike a balance between severity and leniency. So this is, and Wang Huizhu made a similar argument concerning this matter. So we got a sense of how this very ancient, this is actually the sentence, let me see where. 临时不,与其杀无辜,临时不禁, it was an ancient principle from the Book of Documents. So, but it was updated and then adopted by a lot of jurists throughout the period, the whole imperial period. But you got a sense of some of the recurrent themes advocated or promoted by legal advisors to represent themselves as the kind of the upholders of ideal justice. Now I want to give you some specific examples or case studies about the efforts made by Qin legal advisors, not to just to make a counter argument with the Qin Imperial Court to better to provide a better image of themselves, but rather these case studies for me illustrate how Qin legal advisors successfully, I think in many cases, managed to expand their social space, their cultural capital, and their social influence. And to a great extent, they contributed to the development and also the operation of Qin judicial administration and legal culture. Much of the information from this point on, especially, is based on the official handbook. Professor Will has led a group of international scholars. I'm glad to be part of that. it's a huge collection about official handbooks used by that are still existing in various libraries across the world. So I will provide you with some information about the, I think, five major types of activities Qin legal advisors undertook in this regard. The first one concerns the kind of legal commentaries on the Qin Code published by legal advisors or promoted by them. The second type concerns the teaching aids published or wrote by them for others, for the use of others to study the Qin Code or the Qin legal system. The third one is about handbooks for forensic jurisprudence. Professor Will mentioned, wrote a chapter about this. And the fourth category concerns the collection of collections of legal cases for practical guidance or for legal revision or legislative considerations. And the last type concerns handbooks used for local administration, especially judicial administration. I will go over some of them in greater detail. Now, the first type concerns the private legal commentaries on the Qin Code. Shen Zhiqi, I'm sure many of you know, he was a legal advisor from Xiu Shui of Zhejiang province. After 6 or 7 years of hard work, he was a legal advisor for almost the 3 decades. After 6 or 7 years of hard work, he published the Da Qin Lü Ji Zu, often known as Da Qin Lü Ji Jie, Fu Li. And this was one of the, arguably, the most influential private commentary on the Qin Code. It was modeled, it served as a model for most later private legal commentaries. And in 1725, together with Wang Ken Tangzi, Lü Li Jian Shi, this became the basis of the general commentaries included in the Qin Code, officially sanctioned in that year, 1725. And briefly, this book was the main body of the book of the work was divided into two half. Each of the page was divided into two halves, and it included his comment. First, it reprinted the statute, all of the 58 statutes from the Qin Code, and also included the substatutes. And then he included his own commentaries on the nuances of the different provisions, and also the explained the meanings or usages of particular difficult words, phrases, or sentences in the statute. And he also quoted earlier legal commentaries as to the legal rationale or legislative intent of particular provision and so on. So it was very useful for not just for legal advisors or litigation masters, but also for local officials across a whole range of hierarchy to use this book as a kind of shortcut to the Qin Code itself and also very useful tool for judicial interpretation. And his book was updated by Wang Wei Han, I mentioned before, another famous legal advisor from Jiangsu province. Also, Wang Wei Han published a different private commentary on the Qin Code, very much influenced or indebted to Sen's commentary. And then we have another couple of legal legal advisors, including Shen Shucheng, Wang Youhuai, and also others, Yao Ren and so on, who updated the legal commentary on the Qin Code, so kept this work to be updated and continuously useful for Qin legal specialists almost throughout the whole period. And I put also the information about the extant editions of the different works, and you got a sense of the popularity of this work, these works, and also the interrelatedness of these texts. They could be, I mean, for example, Wang Youhuai wrote one of the commentaries, and also he published a series of legal treatises on judicial administration. So these people could work together, they could travel to different places, and many of them worked for 30 years as legal advisors. So they could serve a number of provincial judicial judges as well as magistrates and prefects. So their influence was much more considerable than the number of the works shows. And that is one example. Another example concerns the kind of Professor Will and others have called the synoptic tables of the Qin Code or tabulations of the Qin Code as a study aids for others, for other students of law or specialists in law. Shen Xintian published Min Fa Zhi Zhang, tables on the Qin Code in 1740, and that was kind of inspired by an earlier work by Dong Gongzhen. Dong Gongzhen was also a legal advisor, but Shen Xintian's work, especially the edition in 1743, was much more influential and popular than Dong Gongzhen's work and his earlier edition. So you got at least six different editions of Min Fa Zhi Zhang Zhen Ding, basically the updated versions or revisions of the 1743 edition. And then we have Liu Dawei's Xin Li Zhen Ding, another update in 1825. That has a couple of reprints. And then we have a couple of other similar works inspired by Shen Xintian's Min Fa Zhi Zhang, including Huang Luxi. He was, and Xu Hao. Some of them were not legal advisors per se. I think Xu Hao was not a legal advisor, but the works were inspired by Shen's work. And then we saw Wang Weihan again. He published Lui Li Tu Shuo, also inspired by Shen's work. And also Lu Weitian, another one. So you got, I think, a very concrete sense of how popular these works and how influential these works by legal advisors became over time and also even in their contemporary time. And these are also very convenient studying aids and also provided a great facility for students of law, for other legal advisors or local, especially for me, especially importantly, local officials, including provincial judges. And many, for example, Shen Xintian and also Shen Ziqi and so on, they all ultimately worked for provincial judges. That was the highest level of judicial authorities underneath the Board of Punishment or the Ministry of Justice. And these are two sample pages from Min Fa Zhi Zhang. This is the 1824 Daoguang fourth year of Daoguang reign edition. And on the right-hand side, that's so it's from the main body of the work. You saw how the Qin Code was simplified into tables and how different types of crimes were defined, how they should be punished. And it's very easy for, at least for those with basic knowledge of law, to know how to adjudicate a particular case. And the third category I want to mention is the forensic jurisprudence, the development of forensic jurisprudence in the Qin period, and Wang Yuhuai stood out as one of the most influential specialists in this regard. I mentioned him already a couple of times. I would write an article actually on him. He was certainly one of the most influential legal advisors in the Qin period. And based on some of the collections I had, and it was mostly based on the collections Professor Will and other colleagues have put in the official handbook, I came up with the number of the extant editions. And from 1796 to 1921, we got about 26 different editions or reprints of this work or its derivatives. So so it's 130 years, 26 editions, almost one edition or reprint every 5 years. So you got this, you got a very, I think, a good example of the huge popularity and influence and usage or utility of this kind of work by authored and promoted by legal advisors. And some of the legal advisors involved in this work or its derivative, including Sun Guanglie, also a legal advisor, and Wang Youwu, his brother Wang Youhuai, and also Li Guanlan, he was also involved with Wang Youhuai on compiling a commentary on the legal code, on the Qin code. That commentary became the most popular in the late Qin. And another aspect of this is the large number of officials involved in publishing, in sponsoring or promoting these kinds of works. For example, for this work, we had the governors of Zhejiang, governors of Guangxi, and also expectant intendant, and also a prefect in Fuzhou, and also county magistrates who were actively sponsoring or advocating this kind of work for their subordinate officials or for their colleagues. So this is kind of interaction, also intertextuality between different texts, different realms. The boundary between private legal advisors and public or officials was blurred, certainly, in this kind of occasions. And again, Wang Youhuai was very famous for a number of works. I mentioned some at the bottom. Professor Chu, probably also Professor Bogong will mention some of the legal treaties. But for Wang Youhuai, for example, we know very famously Ban An Yao Lue, which was included in the Ru Mu Xu Zi Wu Zhong. And also Qian Gu Bei Yao, Xin Qian Bi Nan, Zi Zheng Ji Yao Si Zhong, and so on. It's a huge, it's a very significant number of very influential work. This is an example of Wang Youhuai's later edition or update of Wang Youhuai's Xi Yuan Lu Ji Zheng. This is from Tongzi Si Yi Nian, so 1872, I think. So it's you got a sense of how the forensic jurisprudence was updated, made available to sometimes even non-specialists, and also you saw the very colorful pages of the contents or the kind of information provided. Some of them were added by later specialists just to keep the original intact, but also updated with new information. It's very convenient to know what is what. And I just need probably a couple of two or three minutes to wrap it up. I don't have time for the other two categories, but I enumerated some of the major collections of legal cases from this Qin period. All of the main authors or principal authors or editors here are legal advisors. For example, Shun Lun's Ding Li Can He Juan. I think I have some pages, but I don't have time for it. And Hong Hong Xu, he was famous also for commenting on the Qin code, but he was actually also a compiler of Cheng An Zhiyi, a huge, I think probably this thick, the original books, huge compilation of cases from the Shun period up to, I think, the Yongzhen period. So more than 150 years or something. And Zhang Guangyue, another legal advisor from Sanyin, he was the compiler editor of Li An Quanji, and I also put the extant edition information there. Zhu Qingqi, probably we all know, at least those who study Chinese law know Xin An Hui Nan. Zhu Qingqi was actually apparently the principal compiler editor, at least one of the two. Bao Shuying was supervisor, so it's arguable he was just the official Bao Suying was an official, so probably he was invited to put a kind of official sanction or endorsement of the volume. But Zhu Qingqi certainly was very important for this compilation, and he was a legal advisor. I forgot whether he later became an official, but he was a very experienced legal advisor, and we have at least 7 different editions or updates of this collection. And these are 2 sample pages from 2 different work. On the left hand you have the Chen An Ziyi, on the right hand you have the Li An Quanji. They're all from early Qin period, compiled by Qin legal advisors. I don't have to talk about Wang Huizhu. He was arguably the most famous legal advisor, even though his record of his legal work was very rare. So he had some kind of exhortations or didactic lectures on how legal advisors should do their work. But his cases, as far as I can tell, were lost, except for a very few eccentric examples he used to exhort other legal officials. But his work was very influential. For example, for Zhuo Ziyaoyan, that was designed for training legal advisors, or at least providing advice for legal advisors. It went through 9 different editions, and it was reprinted, or its extracts were included in numerous other works authored by officials as well. Before I end, this is a list of some of the most famous or influential legal advisors in the Qin, starting from Sun Lun and so on, Shen Ziqi, Hong Hongxu and so on, then ended up around the time of Chen Tianxi or Wang Zaoyong. I just mentioned Wang Jingwei's cousin was one of the latest legal advisors. And Chen Tianxi was also one of the latest. He moved to Taiwan after 1949 and wrote a memoir about his life as legal advisor. Okay, I think to wrap it up, I hope I have given you enough information examples about the widespread circulation of the works authored by legal advisors, and also the influence of their work, not just their actual practice in helping local administrators, but also the publication of their works or their experience to train other legal advisors or to train other local officials. I think these publications and also especially those cases published, those cases that were decided by legal advisors and published in their names, I only so far have found 4. It's because they were supposedly working in the name of the officials, so they should not be, at least it's kind of against the convention for them to publish their case record under their own names, so it's very rare to see that. But those works did show how important they were to the local administration. I mentioned yesterday the Huangyan Dang'an, the local archive from the Huangyan County in Zhejiang Province, had personal signatures of legal advisors in every legal document we had. So it's very obvious that they were actually indispensable and probably the most important de facto judges in local administration. And that, I hope, will encourage us to go back to re-examine some of their works and to reinterpret the way Qin legal culture was like, and also Qin judicial administration was operated, and how the Confucian educational background of these Qin literati was limited to a very, probably, I think, a narrow extent in terms of the influence of their Confucian education on their legal work. So that goes back to the title. I'm arguing to at a very preliminary stage that there seems to be a kind of process of legalization of Confucian literati, in the sense that they either adopted or developed a kind of professional identity, ethics, and their also as specialists, their way of approaching justice, of perceiving justice, and also of interpreting law to serve that kind of justice. And certainly they were very important for the education of officials as well, and for improving the quality of judicial administration in the Qin period. Thank you very much for your patience.